Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, Happy New Year, ladies and gentlemen. May I be the last to say that to you? Can I? I don't think anybody's going to be behind me in that particular line. Happy New Year, because it's a new year. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, like as we have so often in the last 8-9 years, we're being encouraged to focus on Iraq as if it exists in a vacuum, as if it's the only country that counts. And so if General Petraeus says that the surge is working security-wise, not politics-wise, of course we know that, then, you know, end of story. Until you get to the news of the unsurge. The Asia Times quotes our own United States military as reporting the following, quote, insurgent violence is at its highest level in Afghanistan since the U.S.-led forces ousted the Taliban after the 9/11 attacks against the United States. Suicide bombings have climbed 30% in some areas, unquote. But that's Afghanistan. See, that doesn't really count because that's the unsurge. The issue of what kind of questions are being asked in the presidential campaign arises once again today, at least in my mind. And it takes me back to 2000, when a reporter, I think for a New Hampshire newspaper, for a wire service up there, asked a factual question of then Governor George Bush. And he, the reporter, got roundly criticized by his colleagues for the nature of the question. Because reporters, in case you haven't noticed already, ladies and gentlemen, and we're being reminded of it this very day, political reporters love to ask two kinds of questions of presidential candidates. One, political strategy questions, which proves that the reporters are as savvy as the political consultants who are their sources. You know, Senator, if you don't win in New Hampshire, where are you going to win? What's your strategy? Where's your firewall? Where's your road out? And the other kind of question they love to ask is consistency questions, flip-flop questions, because those are easy to understand for both the questioner and presumably us dumb yucks in the audience. Didn't you say 2 years ago that you were for the immigration bill? So the poor yob wire service reporter or local newspaper reporter who was so out of the loop as to ask an actual factual question of Governor Bush in 2000 was roundly criticized, the subject of ridicule by his savvier Washington-based colleagues. The question was, could Governor Bush name the leaders of four chosen countries around the world? And it's interesting in the light of recent developments to recall George Bush's answer when asked, could he name the leader of Pakistan? Quote, I don't have it on tape, but I have the quote. Quote, the new Pakistani general, he's just been elected. Not elected, this guy took over office. It appears this guy is going to bring stability to the country, and I think that's good news for the subcontinent. Unquote George W. Bush about what turns out to be Pervez Musharraf. But, you know, even if you ask almost the right question, it's tough to get presidential candidates to figure out, at least in this country, how to answer them. Case in point, Charles Gibson on Saturday night's debate on ABC, the Democratic debate, his first two questions were about whether one would, as Senator Obama had said he would, if one had actionable intelligence about the location of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, whether one would send in American troops without the consent of the Pakistani government. And the second question was about the danger of nuclear terrorism. And with those two questions ringing in their ears, none of the Democratic candidates said, well, you know what I'd do? I'd say for our $10 billion in aid to Pakistan, let us interview A.Q. Khan, the father of the Pakistani bomb, who sold nuclear know-how and techniques and materials to at least Libya, Iran, and North Korea. Maybe our $10 billion has bought us that. None of them said that. So maybe it doesn't. Maybe you might as well ask him about the strategy and the flip-flops. Hello, welcome to the show. All new.
I'm gonna love you like nobody loved you, come around.
From the shores of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've ever wondered why a ratty little country wants nuclear weapons. Dateline Tokyo, this is from the Washington Post. North Korea failed to fulfill its promise last October to declare all its nuclear programs by the end of last year. Wow. That's like what Iran did. Or Iraq, failed to declare its nuclear programs. That's serious stuff. And the Bush administration expressed disappointment with the missed deadline. Said the White House spokesman, I'm not going to put a deadline on it. We think there's an opportunity to move forward. Why the nice talk? North Korea, unlike Iran and Iraq, actually does have a nuclear weapon. So, the U.S. talks nice to him. Reason enough, don't you think? And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. The words war on terror will no longer be used by the British government to describe attacks on the public, according to the country's chief prosecutor, reported in the Daily Mail. Sir Ken MacDonald said terrorist fanatics were not soldiers fighting a war, but simply members of an aimless death cult. He said, quote, we resist the language of warfare, and I think the government has moved on this. It no longer uses this sort of language. London is not a battlefield, he said. The people who were murdered on July 7th were not the victims of war. The men who killed them were not soldiers. They were fantasists, narcissists, murderers, and criminals, and needed to be responded to in that way, unquote. His remarks signal a change in emphasis across the British government, where the war on terror language has officially been ditched. Officials were concerned it could act as a recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda, which is determined to manufacture a battle between Islam and the West. The term Islamic terrorist will also no longer be used. Officials believe it is unhelpful because it appears to directly link the religion to terrorist atrocities. And from the British newspaper The Telegraph, British telephone callers may be infuriated when they discover the company they're telephoning has moved customer service to India, but their frustration is as nothing compared with the heart attacks, ulcers, and insomnia afflicting those on the other end of the line. Research carried out by India's booming call center industry has found the 1.6 million people who work in them, mostly in their 20s, are plagued by ailments arising from the stress of dealing with irate customers. The Indian government is so concerned about the problem, it's preparing to launch a health strategy for the workers. 77% call center workers feel very pressurized. 45% identify difficult customers as the main source of their stress. Youngsters love spending the kind of money their parents only dreamt about, but I'm worried that stress and illness will turn them into zombies, says Karthik Shekhar, the general secretary of the Union of Call Center Employees. Hello? The report supports the findings of a health survey by the Indian Council for Research on International Economic Relations, which found the outsourcing industry was most at risk from diseases that would hit productivity. Heart disease, strokes, and diabetes would cost India more than $200 billion in lost productivity over the next 10 years. Staff in call centers dealing with customers in Britain say they have been shocked at the ferocity of the verbal attacks they encounter. The Brits! We thought they were polite tea sippers? Uh-uh. Needy Agarwal, 24, said she had never heard some of the insulting language used, including the word Paki as a term of abuse, before she began taking orders for a British catalog company, which routes its customers' calls to a call center in Bangalore. At first, I thought I'd get used to it, but it's been a year now, and it's not getting easier, she said. On its own, maybe I could cope with the abuse, but there's also the stress of finishing calls in 1 minute and hardly having time for breaks. She plans to quit, tired of wishing customers a good morning, only to hear, quote, "Oh, I'm through to India, am I? Put me through to someone who can understand English, you effing cow," unquote. Most call center workers live in big cities away from home, so they have no family support, says a consultant. Dealing with angry customers can make them very emotionally fragile. They blow their top or cry over the smallest thing. Worried call center managers have also provided cafes and gyms for their staff, and they offer neck massages, disco nights, and picnics in an effort to ease the pressure cooker atmosphere. None of that helped Aradhana Kamath, who left her job working for a British company's call center last May, unable to stand the abuse any longer. "I think they were angry that their jobs had come to India. They were so emotional, angry. It was like instant hatred. I'd want to cry, but I couldn't because I had to take the next call." The Brits. We think they're so polite. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. So, speaking of Pakistan, how are things there now that we've stopped paying attention? Because we got an election. We got important stuff to do. We got flip-flops to track. Pakistan does not need international observers to monitor its nuclear program because it's capable of safeguarding its own weapon stockpile. That's according to opposition leader, the one who wasn't assassinated, Nawaz Sharif. "I don't think we need that," he said in an interview with a Canadian reporter who used to work here, Kevin Newman, used to be on Good Morning America, went back home. Quote, "We're taking care of these things ourselves," said Sharif. He was the guy who ordered Pakistan's nuclear tests in 1998 in response to tests by neighboring India. He says Pakistan has a command and control system in place. Nobody should worry about our nuclear arsenal. That's all well and good. You might say that's trustworthy information coming from him. Till you get to this. Quote, Nawaz Sharif, "There's never been a single case of any proliferation of nuclear technology. While I was prime minister or when Benazir Bhutto was prime minister, no single instance can be quoted on this account. And I think we've been very responsible as far as this is concerned." Unquote. Just ignoring the period when neither of them were prime minister, when Musharraf was president, and AQ Khan was selling nuclear materials to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. Aside from that, there's been no proliferation. And, kind of outside the bubble, because I don't think these details have been reported here. This is from the Times of London. Benazir Bhutto was planning to share a top-secret dossier with two members of the United States Congress, Senator Arlen Specter and Representative Patrick Kennedy. They were due to dine together, and she was to present them the dossier the night of the rally at which she was assassinated. In the dossier was the serious allegation that the ISI, which is the Pakistani intelligence operation, was directly involved in rigging the upcoming parliamentary elections and was using American money to do it. Money was supposed to help Pakistan's armed forces fight al-Qaeda and Taliban militants. But, of course, as we've noted on this broadcast previously, there's been no accounting for the funds, most of which have been transferred in cash directly to the Defense Ministry. It's cash money. It's like Iraq. It's cash money flowing around. Critics of President Musharraf say that much has been diverted towards other aims, including private pockets. You remember him? He used to be in this platoon. Ms. Bhutto wanted to share the report with Senator Specter and Representative Kennedy because she did not entirely trust the official channels of the United States government, which still regards President Musharraf as a key ally in the war on terror. The idea was to discuss it with all the international stakeholders, mainly including Britain and the United States, and we didn't want to share it with anyone who could use it against us, said a spokesman for the Pakistan People's Party. It would be unwise to do anything that would annoy Musharraf and the international stakeholders. Everything could collapse if the army comes to know that there is something substantial against them. It is dangerous to name people in Pakistan. Unquote. Pakistani media reports have alleged the existence of an ISI safe house used to rig the elections and have identified a retired general who heads the Civilian Intelligence Bureau as one of those involved. I'm not going to name him because I like my knees. Ms. Bhutto was also planning to share the report with the British ambassador, Robert Brinkley. A spokesman for the British embassy denied any knowledge of the report. The Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, does not have a spokesperson. But a government official dismissed the reports and the allegations as baseless. Our friends, ladies and gentlemen, our fine ally. Elsewhere in Asia, China is cracking down on vulgar entertainment, asking all video and audio producers to check their inventory for risque material. I know that's what I'd be doing. No, but because they're threatening fines and punishment for those who do not weed out the risque material. Because, you know, Olympics is coming. This is just days after Peking slapped restrictions on internet sites that allow users to upload video or audio, like YouTube, like your YouTube, and handed a 2-year ban on filmmaking to the team behind a steamy film called Lost in Beijing. 2 years, that would take them past the Olympics. This suggests that Beijing is keen to step up its control of the cultural arena ahead of the Olympics, which are widely seen as a coming-out party. Producers of audiovisual content have about 3 weeks to look through their inventory for vulgar items and report them to authorities. I just think the authorities are hungry for titillation. Let's put it that way. Well, this will be followed by about 2 weeks of official checks, then a month to hand out warnings and punishments to any violators who did not voluntarily confess. Some audio-video products, in the name of sexual health and sex education, but without any scientific content, use colorful pictures or text containing seductive words to lure customers, says the government's report. Others publish titillating pictures to attract customers, but under the apparently innocuous title, quote, human body art, it added. It's my favorite kind of art. What are you talking about? What's your problem? And finally, In the mess that is that part of the world, you know, Syria has taken what, a million, 2 million refugees from Iraq. Jordan has taken a million or so, straining their internal infrastructure. We here in the United States, who arguably might have created the situation that caused refugees to want to be refugees in the first place, U.S. admissions of Iraqi refugees are nosediving. Now, the refugees aren't nosediving. The admissions are, according to the Washington Post, amid bureaucratic infighting. The Bush administration pledged to boost them to roughly 1,000 per month. But the decline has been from 450 in October to 362 in November and 245 in December. Hey, the surge is working. Refugees are down. The administration will have to allow in 10,900 refugees over the next 9 months, or roughly 1,200 a month, to meet its own target. That goal will be difficult to meet, and there are few precedents for such influxes, says the Post, since the Vietnamese came in after the you-know-what. Iraqi refugees are subject to more security checks than those from almost all other nations, and the most Iraqis ever admitted to the United States since the war started was 889 last September, because the surge was working. U.S. officials concede the figures remain low, but insist improvements in processing, along with new cooperation from Syrian authorities, will lead to substantial jumps in admission. The goals are still the same, says the State Department. Let's see, 1.2 million are in Syria, 750,000 in Jordan, 100,000 in Egypt, 54,000 in Iran, 40,000 in Lebanon, 10,000 in Turkey, 200,000 in those little countries around the Gulf. And our goal remains the same. But they don't need to come here anymore, because the sage is working.
The clock's running down, the team's losing ground to the opposing defense. The young quarterback waits for the snap, when suddenly it all starts to make sense. He's got all kinds of time, he's got all kinds of time. All kinds of time. He's got all kinds of time. All kinds of time.
This is Le Show from New Orleans, where the newspaper has a story about chefs returning to town because they couldn't stand it where they had gone to live. Yeah, I understand. Just to clarify, ladies and gentlemen, why we might want to talk, why a Democratic presidential candidate asked about nuclear terrorism and Pakistan might say, well, you know, let us talk to A.Q. Khan, please, for our $10 billion, is because, as has been pointed out in this broadcast previously, since his nuclear proliferation ring was broken up, he has been under house arrest in Pakistan, and no United States authorities, no international authorities, no IAEA people have been allowed to talk to him. He has been interrogated only by members of the Pakistani government with which he used to work, you see. House arrest. It's a nice house. I think it's a big house. It's not the big house. Anyway, so, you know, let us in. Hey, Mr. Khan. Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, there was a major thing that happened in the Iowa caucuses. That's not a mountain range. That's a set of meetings. And so Barack Obama, Senator Barack Obama, now finds himself with that victory in hand, and a lead in the polls in New Hampshire. I love John McCain on one of the Sunday morning Yak shows, because try as he might to not talk straight. Sometimes that old devil inside him makes him talk straight after all. So I believe it was George Stephanopoulos asked him about the polls in New Hampshire. And McCain said, well, of course I don't look at the polls. And then he immediately said, but I really do. And then proceeded to discuss the intimate details of the polls that he'd been reading. But, of course I don't look at the polls, but I really do. Thank you for that, sir. If for nothing else, thank you for that. Anyway, the supposed inevitability of Hillary. Now, I don't know if I said it on this broadcast, but I've been saying to friends for maybe 2 years, it's not going to be Hillary Clinton. For a number of reasons. And I'm not a, you know what I do for a living. I don't know anything. But I know this, that there hasn't been a sitting member of the United States Senate elected president since Kennedy. Because they all vote both ways on everything. That's the way the Senate works, you know? And it's just, that's too easy. That's too easy a target. And then the question is raised, well, what about Senator Obama? And my point is the very brevity of his career in the Senate is going to save him from that because he hasn't had enough votes to build a real good flip-flop commercial. Anyway, Senator Clinton now behind in the polls in New Hampshire just a couple days before the primary. And there are news stories which characterize the mood inside her campaign as, quote, desperation but not panic. That's reassuring. At least it's not panic. It's desperation, but it's the good non-panicky kind of desperation. I don't know. To me, it sounds like another episode of really a very special episode of Clinton Something coming up next here on the show.
Clinton Something, the campaign years, all new.
James, I'm sorry. I really need to concentrate on debate prep. I can't concentrate on debate prep when you're sitting here hectoring me with your theories about how we have to shift gears a couple of days before the primary.
Miss Clinton, all due respect, past due. If we don't shift these gears faster than Bobby Rahal ever dreamed of, you know, you can debate prep till the cows come home, and it's not going to affect anyone except maybe the cows.
James, I myself said we never expected to win in Iowa.
I know you said it. We wrote it, but we all expected it. I mean, what the hell was the whole aura of inevitability about if we weren't expecting to win? Do they have cows in New Hampshire?
I know they do in Vermont. Ask Ben and Jerry. Look, James, we tried the experience theme. We tried the change theme. We tried the experience to bring change theme. Mm-hmm. What gear exactly do you think we ought to shift to?
Yeah, you're going to think I'm smoking something.
Well,
I know Mary does, but you know, Mary always does because she's drinking the Kool-Aid. And when you're drinking the Kool-Aid, anybody who isn't looks like they're smoking something. But they're not. They're just not drinking the...
James, I don't have all day. I don't really have any part of the day.
Okay, here's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
Use whatever theme you want. This isn't about themes. It's about you. You got to change something crucial about yourself.
Not my hair again. Jesus, James, this is the longest I've ever had a hairstyle. I cannot...
Your name. You got to be Hillary Rodham. What's poisoned well is the whole Clinton thing.
You might as well ask me to stop having Bill do appearances for me.
That's next. Look, as long as this looks like a campaign for the restoration of the previous regime, nobody's going to believe it's about the future. You might as well have Fleetwood Mac rewrite our old campaign song to go, "Don't stop thinking about the day before tomorrow."
That doesn't even scan. Yeah. Besides, James, what good is all my name recognition if I change my name? And how inevitable can I look if I'm going around scratching Bill's name off all my posters? Jeez, I can't think of anything more desperate sounding. More aura of uninevitability.
Hmm. Now, what if you go all hyphenated? You know, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Kind of slurring, mumbling the second half. That's very contemporary. All the chicks at NPR do that now.
All the what?
The women, you know, the double X's. Mm-hmm. It says to them, I'm not trading them my husband's name. You know me, so let's put away all the things of the past. Like the name Clinton.
And like James Carville?
Hey, we're not plotting revolution here, are we?
Look, James, if I thought I could draw half the crowds without having to share the stage with Bill, do you think for a moment I wouldn't ask him to go back to Harlem and chase some young skim latte thing around the desk? I had empty seats last night as it was.
You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
I know that's the most repeated cliche in the first half of this decade.
Look, nobody wants the old gang to get that old address more than I do just for the sheer pleasure of rubbing Mary's nose in it. But I'm just saying if it looks like that's what we're doing, this is the wrong year to be doing it in. In fact, this is the wrong year to rely on inevitability for momentum. We gotta be the uber underdog. People love underdogs.
You mean I have to be the comeback granny?
Chelsea's pregnant?
You know what I mean.
All right, let's just jujitsu Obama's victory into him being Mr. Inevitable, and we're the ones who are fighting to stay alive. See, and that's why we're throwing all the Clinton baggage overboard. You're in the lifeboat. You don't need anything that's weighing down the boat. See, now that's a big-picture narrative that justifies what we want to do anyway.
James, you could talk me into eating pan-roasted nutria. The point is, you can never talk Bill into it. His ego would be so crushed, and we both know that's when he's at his most dangerous.
Mrs., you go back to your debate prep. You let me work on the baggage.
Now, Mark, just bring up those 24 to 35s again.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, the rurals are skewing for Hill. And the urbans are skewing Obama, so...
So we need to manufacture a lot more rurals in the next 3 days.
No, we need to robo-call the spit out of the C and D counties.
Sir, there are no A and B counties in New Hampshire.
Well, then let's robo-call the crap out of the E and F counties. I don't care if...
Hey, Mr. President, Mr. Campaign Director.
Hi, James. Welcome to the post-postmortem.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is it the post-mortem-mortem?
James, we think surrounding Hillary with younger people on the podium is a very winning strategy. Don't confuse a mortem with a partum.
Oh, too much Latin, man. Mr. President, just a word.
Yeah, Mark, you want to run those psychographics through the algo-riser one more time?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, this is supposed to be a campaign about change. Mm-hmm. If we don't change something major about this campaign like yesterday, we're going to be sitting here Tuesday evening sifting off as election analysts from CNN and Fox. At least I will.
James, bud, couldn't agree with you more. Frankly, you know, man, I blame myself.
You do?
Yeah. I've just been too much in the spotlight. Haven't left enough oxygen for Hill. She's got to run as the candidate of the future, and I'm the past.
Well, you know, I came over here to...
I know. Hill knows I feel this way and sent you over to talk me out of it. I know the woman, man. She wants to be out of my shadow, but at the same time, that's her comfort zone.
Yeah.
Also, of course, if I stay in my current role and we stiff in New Hampshire, she's got me to blame. And that's her comfort zone, too.
But you don't feel that way.
No, and no, I don't, James. Of course I don't. But at this point in the campaign, I think the best thing I can do for Hill is not to fight against her instincts, her impulses, whatever you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
If I pull the plug on myself, it's a very direct slap at her because it's my decision, not hers.
Yeah, but you know, in fairness, I think she's perfectly capable of making that decision.
In theory, so do I.
Mm-hmm.
But when she's scared... And hey, man, I think Mr. Obama has thrown a big scare into half the Democratic Party right now. When she's scared, she sends me those I need you signals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting them loud and clear right about now.
You are? Mm-hmm. Because I just came from her headquarters, and I can't truly say that was the kind of signal she was sending to me.
No, man, it's all subverbal.
Mm.
You got that great strong front, but right now, she's a scared little 7-year-old. And she needs taken care of.
Well, Sir, I'm just hypothecating here. But what if she did want you to, step back from the lip of the stage a little bit?
James, I'll know when she wants that. And when that time comes, you better not get between me and the upstage curtain. Now get your ass out of here, man. Mark and I have some young New Hampshire women to slice and dice.
All right, sir. I'll go have me some Nutria for dinner.
Youthful angst and middle-aged hunger for power. Together, they add up to Clinton something. The campaign years.
Treat me wrong, treat me right, sleep through the day, stay out all night, as long as you love me, from the start, from the heart.
Ladies and gentlemen, clean, safe, plentiful nuclear power is in the news again. The Washington Post reports that a gentleman by the name of Kerry Beale was taken aback when he discovered last March that many of his fellow security guards at Peach Bottom Nuclear Power Plant in Pennsylvania were taking regular naps in what they called the ready room. When he spoke to supervisors at his company, Wackenhut, they told him to be a team player. When he alerted the regional office of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they let the matter drop after the plant's owners, Exelon, said it found no evidence of guards asleep on the job. So Beale videotaped the sleeping guards and gave it to Channel 2 in New York. Snoozing against walls, they were slumped on tabletops with eyes closed and heads bobbing. This wasn't Homer Simpson. This were real people, real guards at a nuclear plant. Last month, Exelon, the country's largest provider of nuclear power, that makes you feel safe, fired Wackenhut, which had guarded each of its 10 nuclear plants. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is reviewing its own oversight procedures, having failed to heed Beale's warning. And Wackenhut says the entire nuclear industry needs to rethink security. Really? Wackenhut has a long history of alleged flaws in its nuclear security operations. The NRC has referred 40% of wrongdoing allegations back to the people who run the plants. Hey, investigate yourself. We're busy here. Wackenhut's David Lockbaum, a nuclear safety expert at the Union of Concerned Scientists, faults the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for failing to connect the dots between Peach Bottom and other complaints about Wackenhut. And Eric Wilson, the head of Wackenhut's nuclear security operations, has pointed a finger at the plant owners like Exelon. In a slide presentation he made to watchdog groups last year, he said nuclear plant owners have pressed so hard for lower costs that, quote, we are now down to the bone, and the current business model does not yield consistently acceptable performance levels, unquote. The chief executive of Exelon admits, their contractor worked for us. Their performance is ultimately our responsibility. There's no way to paint that wagon any brighter, unquote. Nuclear chiefs are going to give British citizens millions of dollars of taxpayers' money in hopes that they'll accept the dumping of nuclear radioactive waste near their home. Some $150 million for expanding the only national dump for low-level nuclear waste. The deal is being called a bribe by some. And British scientists are condemning as undemocratic and possibly illegal the British government's plans to force through a new generation of nuclear power plants. So, clean, safe, plentiful. Near you? You want them? You can have them. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
In a dramatic U-turn, Pakistan's government has apologized for claiming that former Premier Benazir Bhutto died of a skull fracture. Caretaker Interior Minister Hamid Nawaz Khan has asked the media and people to forgive and ignore comments made by his spokesman, which were slammed by critics as lies. The Interior Minister made the apology during a briefing for Pakistani newspaper editors on Monday. U.S. troops helping to track Islamic militants in the Philippines have apologized for forcing a local hospital in the southern Philippines to close every night, according to an army general. The troops told the officials to close the hospital every night and prevent medical personnel from treating patients after sundown. There were alleged threats to U.S. forces camped near the hospital, the general said, but he did not elaborate on what they were. They have apologized. We told them not to talk to the hospital staff and not to go inside, said General Ruperto Pabustan, head of Filipino Special Forces, on the meeting. The apology came in a recent meeting between U.S. commanders and local officials in Jolo. The chief of staff at an embattled new hospital in Brampton, I believe that is in Ontario, Canada, has apologized to a 72-year-old grandmother whose Christmas Day surgery to repair a broken thigh was allegedly botched when the doctor cut into the wrong leg. Her family says the doctor who sliced open the right leg when he should have cut into her left has also expressed his regret. Just parenthetically, when I had my shoulder surgery recently, they actually gave me a magic marker just before the surgery and told me to write the word yes on my right shoulder because that's the one they were supposed to operate on. Just in case, you know? I guess the Canadians can't afford magic markers. Malaysia Health Minister Chua Sol Lek resigned this week, a day after he shocked the nation by admitting he was the man in widely circulated sex videos. Prime Minister Badawi accepted the resignation of the father of three and doctor, who apologized after two lengthy DVDs hit the street showing him engaging in sexual acts with a woman he identified as a, quote, personal friend. And three rogue Chicago police officers who robbed drug dealers of cash and narcotics were sentenced to lengthy prison terms this week by a federal judge who said the misconduct left him at a total loss. Yeah, doesn't understand why guys with guns and the ability to seize drugs would want to turn around and sell them. Yeah, it's very bewildering. He appeared most disturbed that the officers resold the stolen drugs. One of the officers appealed to the judge for mercy, calling family members and friends. One testified about his time in the Navy when he worked as a jet mechanic. My mother raised me to be a hard worker, honest, said Officer Jones, a beefy man in an orange prison jumpsuit. I learned responsibility at an early age. Basically, I'm in a situation because of greed. I'm not a bad guy. Another of the officers called police work his passion. He apologized to the city and said, I have dropped the baton. Apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Hey, just a couple of days left to vote. No. Not in the New Hampshire primary. For the Grammys. Yes. Yes, I'm nominated. Why do you ask? From said CD.
A farewell tip from Clinton that Bush chose to ignore. A lessening of emphasis when the experts called for more. Some strange young guys in flight school who couldn't love to land. And tragedy. 100 knots. Next time, we'll connect the dots. Life gives you clues that you can use. Sometimes makes the news seem so clear in the land of afterthoughts. We'll be right back.
was the chairman of a firm known far and wide for doing well, rebuilding what the army just destroyed. Got his deals the easy way, no bidding to withstand. Them that has might just be them that got. Next time, we'll connect the dots. Life gives you crumbs, you take what comes. Some just might be plums. Are these only neat ideas, or are they plots? One day we'll connect the dots. Can't find Saddam's weapons with the finest fine tooth comb. Assam is still in business, but the inspectors have all gone home. Can't really be a quagmire if it's just made out of sand. Things are going great. Ignore the shots. Go buy some stuff. Don't worry about the dots. Life gives you clues that you can use. Sometimes makes the news. Some of us in lifeboats, some in yachts. One day soon we'll connect the dots. Connect the dots. Connect those lovely.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program all new. The program is going to return next week at the same time over these same stations. And it'll be just like asking the candidates serious questions and getting serious answers. If you could agree to join me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast, you can find the same place you can find the playlist of the music featured on this broadcast, harryshearer.com. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks, to Pam Halstead, as always, and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.
You go vote now.